Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
As the G8 becomes the G7 once again, what other price might Russia pay? We'll talk about that on the broadcast today. Also, how your last name might improve your economic chances in life. Here's a hint. Rizdal gets you nothing. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday today, the 24th of March. Good as always to have you with us. President Obama, as you probably know, is in Europe today for what is ostensibly a summit meeting on nuclear security. The real action, however, is on the sidelines, as the diplomats like to say, as Mr. Obama and his counterparts from the G7 get their heads together to figure out next steps vis-a-vis Russia, Crimea, and Vladimir Putin. In a press conference this morning, President Obama once again used his "there will be costs to Russia for this action" line. So we figured now is as good a time as any to look at what those costs might have been so far. Here's Marketplace's Mark Arison.
Russia's key stock index is down nearly 14% this year. That's tens of billions in company value gone. This as the ruble has sunk. Cliff Kupchan of Eurasia Group lays out the sanctions so far.
We sanctioned a number of oligarchs very close to Mr. Putin, but only one company, Bank Russia, which is alleged to run a lot of the Kremlin's money.
A handful of Russian billionaires may not sound like a sweeping move, but it's more than you might think.
It's also every single entity that these individuals own or control.
International lawyer Christopher Swift of Foley & Lardner points out that these oligarchs weave tangled webs.
Because a lot of these individuals operate their business empires through third-party proxies and shell companies in Europe and North America, the scope is much broader than most people assume just looking at this list.
And that's before we get to what else the U.S. and allies could do.
These are the initial stages of what could be a more comprehensive financial isolation campaign.
Juan Zarate is senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Russia had economic trouble well before the crisis in Ukraine.
I think there had already been questions as to the strength of the Russian economy, and then you add to this the uncertainty as to what may come, and I think investors are starting to worry as to what the next stages are.
Which means, says Cliff Kupchan, that even companies not on the list could suffer.
Everybody's now wondering what Russian companies indeed are off limits. Should I consummate a deal with ex-Russian company, or will I be sanctioned?
Harsher sanctions aren't in place yet, but global business leaders are starting to act like they're coming. That means Russia could lose out on deals and investment it needs. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
From the pages of the Wall Street Journal this morning came this next story that Apple and Comcast are discussing a deal to give Apple special access to Comcast's cables. That is, the cables that bring cable television into your home. Apple would then deliver streaming television through a set-top box. And while there is a lot of negotiating yet to be done before this deal happens, it is yet another skirmish in the long-running and oh-so-high-stakes battle over who gets access to your living room. Marketplace's David Weinberg has that story.
The deal, if it is a deal, would give Apple access to what's called the last mile. This is the last section of cable that runs from a neighborhood box into individual homes. Kevin Werbach teaches business ethics at the Wharton School of Business.
Apple would get what's called managed service access. So their content would go over a distinct high-priority pipe across the Comcast network and not be mixed in with other internet traffic.
As you have probably noticed, the quality of video on your TV can vary greatly between traditional cable and streaming TV. Take Netflix, for example. Lots of people had trouble streaming the new season of House of Cards, so Netflix agreed to pay extra to Comcast for more bandwidth. Craig Aaron, president of Free Press, a consumer advocacy group, says a managed service deal with Apple would be great for Comcast because it would allow the cable company to maintain its role as a gatekeeper for content.
Apple should be a competitor with Comcast. Netflix should be a competitor with Comcast, helping bring down prices, offer more choices.
But, says Aaron, under a managed service deal, Apple's content would have to go through the cable company's infrastructure, effectively turning Comcast's biggest threat into a source of revenue. It also solves another problem for Comcast. Increasingly, people aren't signing up for cable. Instead, they're using apps and internet devices to watch video. A deal like this would also make Comcast relevant in the new media landscape. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, the Dow was down, but not much. The S&P 500 was down, but not much. The NASDAQ, though, got whacked with a capital W. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A couple of times a year, we do a special collaboration with the New York Times. The latest, that starts this week, today in fact, is called Work in America. To get us going, a story about conflict in the workplace between older, I mean more experienced workers, and those who are younger. Surveys and studies show that millennials, as demographers call them, get grades of C or lower for preparedness for the workplace, and that they are difficult to manage and sometimes lack solid work ethics. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman spent some time with millennials and their managers, and he found that when it comes to intergenerational conflict in the office, the more things change, the more they stay the same.
The millennials, they're the look-at-me generation, psychologists say. Coddled by parents and teachers, wedded to their selfies and smartphones, putting social life ahead of work life. And here's what a middle-aged manager who's actually been supervising them for years says.
They tend to be very self-absorbed. They also value fun in their personal and in their work life. They expect to be rewarded for going to college versus having any real work experience.
That's Robert Boggs, head of academic services at Corinthian Colleges in Southern California. He recently wrote a paper to help guide other college administrators in dealing with young people's work style and work ethic.
Because they've grown up being able to multitask on whatever device they happen to have, I can't expect them to work on one project without them getting bored. They think they can figure everything out. They don't understand why they're not, you know, the boss.
You can find these complaints in ancient Greek literature. You can find them in the Bible. There's nothing new about this. I think it reflects the way old people see young people.
That's Peter Capelli, director of the Human Resources Center at the Wharton School. And he says, try to remember back when you were 22. If you were a boomer, that's the me generation. Gen X, well, then you were the poster child for slacker.
You probably, you know, remember that you wanted to get out of the office in a hurry, that you were interested in what was going on after work, that you had these bursts of energy, great enthusiasm about something, but you also didn't have a lot of resilience.
But proof of just how pervasive the negative image of millennials is, they share it themselves. Camille Perry is 26. She works part-time at a neighborhood bar and karaoke lounge in Portland, Oregon.
Just a prevalent laziness, honestly. We are a generation that spent a lot of time in front of the television or playing video games continually.
Perry was serving up cheap beers to the after-work crowd, and I asked her, what's it like to be a young worker? She told me when the next bartender who's middle-aged comes on duty,
I'm constantly obsessing about making sure that everything is just perfect for him to come into. I don't want it to look like just because I'm young, like I didn't do my job all day.
Perry also works at a restaurant and recently interviewed for an internship at a literary magazine. And that's characteristic of her generation, independent, scrappy, self-starting. They need to be. In this economy, they don't expect any job to last very long. Scott Ruthfield, 39, sees this at the recruiting firm he runs in Seattle. He says young people today are definitely less committed to their employers than previous generations.
But I think that has less to do with a lack of conscientiousness and more sort of a recognition that the company is not going to bury you when you die. And you've seen your parents go through larger companies that don't take care of them. You realize that you are responsible for your own well-being.
Paul Taylor at the Pew Research Center says millennials can be a good bet for employers. Their upbringing has stressed collaboration and sharing of information and success.
They are a generation that is not conflictual. They don't want to get into fights with people. My guess is that augurs well for their ability to adapt and get along well in a workplace setting.
This does not mean millennials aren't a challenge to their bosses. Tracy Altman's in her 40s, works at a Seattle marketing firm. Her assistant, Emily Feliciano, mid-20s.
Emily's very colorful. She's very flirty, sassy, young person.
Altman says she's had to adjust to the way Feliciano and her other young colleagues mix social life, recreation, and work all day and after hours.
There's just more of a like, hey, I'm going to spend 8 to 10 hours a day here. I want to have fun with my coworkers. I want to enjoy what I'm doing. Whereas older workers, you know, my generation, probably we were taught more to suck it up because you're darn lucky to have a job.
Altman's gotten used to Feliciano's sparkle pens, her always messaging someone on some device. But the perseverance and devotion to the job thing? Altman nods vigorously when Feliciano says,
I am big on having work to do, and I don't like to be bored. I do a lot of things, and I'm always stacking in my schedule, whether they're social or for work, so that I'm never late. If I miss something, I'm sick or dead.
When the Pew Research Center surveyed millennials about what makes their generation unique, they put technology, pop culture, and clothes near the top of their list. Gen Xers and baby boomers now say things like having a good work ethic and being respectful set them apart. Chances are today's younger generation will eventually grow up to become dutiful middle-aged worker bees too. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Our collaboration with the New York Times is called Work in America. You can read all of it online later tonight in the actual newspaper tomorrow, also at marketplace.org. Coming up,
when you're thinking of marrying someone, you shouldn't look at Match.com. You should go to Ancestry.com.
No, come on. It's not what you think. But first, let's do the numbers. Ho-hum day for most of Wall Street was a bummer for the tech sector. The Dow Industrials tiptoed down about 26 points, 10%, closed at 16,276. The S&P 500 knocked off 9 points, nearly a half percent, ended things at 1857. The tech-heavy NASDAQ was the biggest loser. It shed 50 points, 1.1%, finished at 4226. As David Weinberg reported up top, investors were digesting the news of that Apple Comcast set-top box deal, perhaps. Netflix shares dropped 6% today. Apple ticked up 1%. Comcast wired on 0.6% today. Other tech darlings took it on the chin today as well. Facebook shares dropped 4%. Tesla Motors lost nearly that much. Google shares down 2% today. Southwest Airlines revealed plans to begin new nonstop flights from Dallas Love Field to Washington's Reagan National Airport. Southwest's ticker symbol LUV added on 0.8% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.73%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Senate Energy Committee holds a hearing on importing energy, exporting jobs. Can it be reversed? The Conference Board releases its monthly Consumer Confidence Index. And March is National Frozen Food Month. TV dinners, ice cream, edamame, and a microwave. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Ticker symbol XOM closed up a touch this afternoon, $94.64 a piece. That's about $83 a share higher than ExxonMobil was 25 years ago today, when the Exxon Valdez spilled millions of gallons of oil into Prince William Sound up in Alaska. It was, of course, an environmental story, one that endures to this day. It's also a story of risk, risks that are known and accepted. Marketplace's Adrienne Hill reports.
If you were alive during the Valdez oil spill, you can probably still recall the video footage. Black shorelines, dead sea otters, oil-soaked birds.
It was vivid.
Zygmunt Plotter is an environmental law professor at Boston College. He worked on the Alaska Oil Spill Commission after Valdez.
It pointed to the problems of the oil megasystem.
Every step of the process, says Plotter.
There was repeated cost-cutting to increase risk. Our commission concluded that this megasystem was dominated by complacency, collusion, and neglect.
Words we heard after the BP Deepwater Horizon oil spill 20 years later. Valdez also showed us how vulnerable the environment can be in a way that previous oil spills, including the Santa Barbara spill in 1969, had not. Bob Deans is a spokesperson for the Natural Resources Defense Council.
It underscored the enormous risk that we place natural resources at when we produce and distribute oil.
The risk, he says, was something we hadn't quite come to terms with.
There was this perception that it was safe to do this, and that if the oil got in the water, surely industry had a way to clean it up. Surely there was a way to save the oceans and marine life from the consequences of a spill like this. And we found out that none of that was true.
After the Exxon Valdez, and again after the BP oil spill, regulations were tightened. But oil spills are not a thing of the past. Over the weekend, about 170,000 gallons of oil gushed out into Galveston Bay when an oil barge and cargo ship collided. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
This week, with our partners at the BBC, we're looking at the global problem of obesity. There are a lot of things that happen as countries and their populations get richer. Some of them are good, some of them aren't. The amazing economic growth in China the past generation or two has brought shiny new skyscrapers and bullet trains, an emerging middle class, and disposable income. And that has changed what people spend money on. Hundreds of millions of Chinese have switched from a farmer's diet of fresh fruits and vegetables to an urban menu filled with fast food and high fat, which has meant an astonishing rise in diabetes there. Our China correspondent Rob Schmitz reports.
It was last September when doctors realized how bad China's diabetes epidemic really was. The most comprehensive survey ever conducted in China revealed 114 million people, a population the size of Mexico's, now has the disease. Paul Zimmet is honorary president of the International Diabetes Federation. He says the sheer number of diabetics in China is catastrophic. It's forced him to frame the global epidemic in a new way.
We're now saying that if diabetes was a country, it would only be third, actually, after China and India as a country, because we're now seeing something like 380 million people worldwide with diabetes.
And one in every three of them now lives in China. There are people like Ye Bin, a 35-year-old salesman who meets me for lunch near his Shanghai office. Before the food arrives, he arranges a handful of pills beside his chopsticks. It's medicine to treat type 2 diabetes. He places the pills in his mouth one by one.
It's been a year since I was diagnosed. Now I try not to eat anything with sugar. I used to drink soft drinks all the time. I can't do that anymore.
Ye grew up as an only child. He belongs to a generation defined by China's one-child policy. 100 million individuals nicknamed Little Emperors. Ye's parents, business types who became rich off of China's growth, spoiled him. They grew up surrounded by famine and violent political campaigns. Like many Chinese parents in the 1980s, they wanted an easier life for their only son.
When I was young, we ate out 3 or 4 times a week. At home, my parents always fed me Ferrero Rocher chocolates. We had lots of those at home. They were a sign of wealth back then.
Another sign you made it was dining out at the increasing number of American fast food restaurants in China. A girl in a McDonald's commercial screams, "I've got a magic box!" She holds up her Happy Meal. It's a reminder of how the diabetes epidemic began in the United States. But in China, the conditions seem even more ripe. Globalization, urbanization, and in terms of exercise, stagnation.
Fewer people ride bicycles in China these days. Fewer people walk. More people are driving cars.
Dr. Xu Zhangrong is deputy secretary of the China Diabetes Society.
Think of the environmental factors. The air is often smoggy, so fewer people go outside to exercise.
In 1980, less than 1% of Chinese adults had diabetes. Now it's at least 10%. One in four Chinese have abnormal blood sugar levels, a precursor to the disease. Dr. Xu says the sudden rise of diabetes in China is not only a health threat, but an economic one. He says it could bankrupt the country's healthcare system.
It's a big problem. About 80% of the expenditures on diabetes treatment in China goes to treating complications, the most expensive type of treatment. But because many Chinese can't afford proper health care, they're forced to wait until they experience complications.
It's standing room only in the waiting room of a diabetes clinic in Shanghai. More than 100 people take a number and wait for an automated voice to direct them to an available doctor. With plans to move 100 million people to the city in the next 5 years, Dr. Xu says waiting times in China will only become longer. But Xu says one thing can't wait. China needs to shift its focus from treating diabetes to preventing it. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
As if it just being a Monday wasn't enough by itself to get you down, here is one more thing. Your last name may have a whole heck of a lot more to do with your chances of success than you think. That's the research in a new book by Gregory Clark. He's an economics professor at the University of California, Davis. His book is called The Sun Also Rises, S-O-N there. And the very general upshot is that if your ancestors were doing all right, you're probably doing all right, too. And if not, probably not. Professor Clark, thanks for coming on.
Oh, great to be here.
I confess I almost passed on this book because I was like, oh, come on, surnames. How reliable can they be? And yet they can. They are, you say, surprisingly powerful as a predictor of social mobility.
Yes, especially in a society like America, where you have many different ethnic groups coming together with very different economic fortunes and then very distinct surnames.
How do you measure this, though? Because there are permutations and combinations of surnames and economic statuses and all kinds of things.
Well, it turns out that if you take any measure of social status and then look at people by surname groupings, it'll pretty reliably show which are the high-status groups and which are the low-status groups. And one of the interesting things with the surnames is that we actually detect in the U.S. using them groups that we hadn't even previously thought of as distinctive, such as people with French surnames in the U.S. for some reason are actually an underclass.
I'm gonna let that pass without a comment. What about people with Norwegian surnames, just for the heck of it, you know?
They're very average.
Very
completely average. Almost
Touché.
All European surname groups are very much average, apart from the French.
Assuming somebody in Washington picks this book up and reads it in depth, what are they to make of your findings in a country where we spend no small amount of national wealth on ensuring equal opportunity of mobility, even if it doesn't get there in practice? I mean, this is a vital public policy issue in this country.
Yes, and I think what the book is showing is that even societies that have spent much more effort than the U.S. in trying to increase rates of social mobility have not, by and large, succeeded. That modern social mobility rates are no higher than in medieval England or in pre-industrial Sweden. And that even dramatic events like the Communist Revolution in China had very little effect on underlying social mobility rates. And so what it would say to policymakers is you should think much more instead about, well, what's the reward for ending up in high or low positions in societies, as opposed to how much can we influence who's going to end up in those positions? Because the evidence is that we just can't do very much to change that.
What else might one use this for? I'm thinking of colleges in the application process and businesses in the hiring process. I mean, there's any number of ways that you could look at this data and say, oh, yeah, this guy named Smith is going to be fine, but the guy named Rizdal, forget it. He's going nowhere.
Once you know the details of a person, the surname in general will not give you more information. I mean, it's really measuring things at group levels, right?
Right.
And there's lots of people with low-status surnames who are going to be at the top of the achievement distribution. The only case that the book finds that this would matter would be if your goal in life is to produce high-status children, it would actually be a guide to dating. And so the idea of the book is that you shouldn't look at Match.com, you should go to Ancestry.com, if that's your ambition, right? But there's lots of other reasons for getting married to people other than worrying about what college your children are likely to go to.
That is a fact. The book is called The Sun Also Rises, S-O-N Also Rises, by Professor Gregory Clark. He's a professor of economics at the University of California, Davis. Professor, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, in which really there is no clear outstanding marketplace angle. I just thought it was kind of cool. Researchers at the University of Michigan say they have discovered a way to make contact lenses that have night vision capability. It's all about using super thin layers of graphene, if you want to know the science of it. You can call me a geek. Go ahead. But still, it is kind of cool. I think. Anyway. All right, we're done on a Monday. That is Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow tiptoed down about 26 points, a 10%. The NASDAQ off 50 points, 1.1%. The S&P 500 knocked off 7 points, about a third of 1% there. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Tommy Andres, and Melissa Yeager-Miller. Millie Jefferson directs the program. I am Kai Rizdahl, and we will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.